This is day five of this January 2019 Rohatsu 7-Day Sesshin. We'll be taking up a koan today. This is from the Blue Cliff record, Hekigan Roku. It's number 61. Fuketsu's One Particle of Dust. Fuketsu is the Japanese name of this Chinese master. His Chinese name is Feng Shui, more or less. So we'll use the Chinese name. Feng Shui said to the assembled monks, "If one particle of dust is raised, the state will come into being. If no particle of dust is raised, the state will perish." And then Secho, at a later time, raising his staff, said to his disciples, "Is there anyone among you who can live with it and die with it?" So we do have some biographical information about Feng Shui, turning to our Zen's Chinese Heritage by Andy Ferguson. We're told that his dates were the 900s, basically. Studied Confucianism as a youth and failed on his first attempt to pass the state civil exams. This is a huge milestone or crucible in China at the time, still for some in Japan, but above all in China at that time, to study for the state civil exams and fail them was kind of a blight at the time, kind of a blight on one's life. So much is invested in becoming a government official of some rank or other, but you had to pass these exams. In disappointment, he left home and was ordained under a Vinaya master. He delved into the Lotus Sutra. And then he traveled to broaden his understanding. At the age of 25, he trained with Zen master Dao Fu. But he still was left unable to uncover the root of Zen, it says here. So he went on traveling and eventually trained under the rigorous Zen master Nan Yuan. He remained with him for 6 years and finally awakened to the way and became his teacher's Dharma heir. In 931, he traveled to such and such where he began teaching at the already old and dilapidated Feng Shui Temple. That's where he got his name, from the mountain. His reputation grew, his ability, word of his ability spread, and before long, Zen monks were gathering all around him. The temple was beyond repair, however, so he and his students moved to a newly built temple, where he remained as abbot for 22 years. And then here are some dialogues involving Nan Yuan, or Feng Shui, rather. So his teacher, under whom he came to enlightenment, Nan Yuan, asked him, "What's your opinion about the Staff of the South?" That was a moniker for Linji. "What is your opinion about him?" Feng Shui said, I say it's quite unusual. And then Feng Shui himself asked Nan Yuan, what does the master say about the staff in this place? Nan Yuan picked up his staff and said, those unable to endure the staff will not see Lin Qi as their teacher. At these words, Feng Shui deeply realized the great meaning of the Lin Qi school, Rinzai. Staff often just represents understanding or enlightenment. What does the master say about the staff in this place? Once Feng Shui addressed the monks, and he cited one of his predecessors, an ancient master, who said, I have an arrow, I have sharpened it for many ages. When I shoot, it flies through the 10 directions. No one can see where it falls to earth. And then Feng Shui himself said, but as for me, I don't go along with this. I have an arrow that has never been sharpened. It doesn't shoot through the 10 directions. But still, no one can see it. Then a monk asked, what is the master's arrow? Feng Shui pretended to shoot the monk with a bow and arrow. The monk bowed. Feng Shui yelled, drag this dead fellow out of here. So the older master, the previous master, says he has this arrow. Feng Shui says, this arrow, his own arrow, has never been sharpened. It doesn't shoot. It's beyond coming and going. It doesn't need sharpening. From the one side, we can say, there's nothing to do, nowhere to go. We are endowed with this nature, full, whole and complete, from the beginningless time. Everything is resolved. From the other side, there's a lot to do. A lot of sharpening. Now here is a little exchange where today's koan is filled out. Feng Shui said to the monks, establish one mote of dust and the nation flourishes. The villagers knit their brows in anxiety. Not establishing one mote of dust and the nation is lost. Then the 100 households live in peace. When you understand this, then there is nothing more, and everything is your teacher. If this is not understood, then your teacher is a monk. This teacher and monk can together enlighten the entire world or blind the entire world. Do you want to know who the monk is? Feng Shui then slapped his right side and said, he's right here. Then Feng Shui said, do you want to know the teacher? Feng Shui then slapped his left side, said, he's right here. And now back to the koan. If a single particle of dust is raised, the state will come into being. If no particle of dust is raised, the state will perish. Well, it's not giving too much away to say that dust here represents, in one sense, it represents thoughts, concepts. And this is our uniquely human predicament. Thoughts, concepts, is at root the self concept, self-consciousness, out of this one thought. The world is divided into self and other, us and them, and from that is spawned the whole world of suffering. This word suffering is the common translation of the first of the Four Noble Truths, dukkha. You could arguably also define it as dissatisfaction. I think an even more contemporary version of it would be frustration or anxiety. Anxiety in its many, many forms that so many people now recognize is part of their life. Well, there's anxiety or frustration, and then there's the recognition that that is the nature of unenlightened existence, is suffering and dissatisfaction, frustration and anxiety. Everyone has these things, these forms of dukkha, one degree or another, but how many people can step back and see that the problem is not out there. The problem is in the way we see things. The problem originates in our own mind. One of the very particular forms of suffering of us Americans is this unending quest for happiness. There's a passage here I've read before. I'd like to read it again. That really sort of captures the whole mass of dissatisfaction that is what it is to be human. And I don't have the author, but let's just read it anyway. We convince ourselves that life will be better after we get married, have a baby, then another. Then we are frustrated that the kids aren't old enough and will be more content when they are. After that, we're frustrated that we have teenagers to deal with. We will certainly be happy when they are out of that stage. We tell ourselves that our life will be complete when our spouse gets his or her act together. when we get a nicer car, are able to go on a nice vacation, when we retire. The truth is, there's no better time to be happy than right now. If not now, when? Your life will always be filled with challenges. It's best to admit this to yourself and decide to be happy anyway. For a long time, it had seemed to me that life was about to begin, real life. But there was always some obstacle in the way, something to be gotten through first, some unfinished business, time still to be served, a debt to be paid. Then life would begin. At last it dawned on me that these obstacles were my life. And she or he says, so stop waiting until you finish school, until you go back to school, until you lose 10 pounds, until you gain 10 pounds, until you have kids, until your kids leave the house, until you start work, until you retire, until you get married, until you get divorced, until Friday night, until Sunday morning, until you get a new car or home, until your car or home is paid off, until spring, until summer, until fall, until winter, until you're off welfare, until the 1st or 15th, until your song comes on, until you've had drink, until you've sobered up, until you die, until you are born again, to decide that there is no better time than now to be happy. At some point in our lives, as we develop awareness and the brain reaches a certain point, this is often adolescence, we realize the fix that we're in, the human predicament of not just how things are never quite the way we want them to be, but that we're headed for a cliff. That sooner or later, we're going to die. Which a surprising number of people say they're not afraid of. Ask them about the dying itself. In any case, there is this human awareness of our mortality that is our burden. How do we deal with that? You could say that the movement toward dealing with it is the journey. And it's a journey that any aware human being of any culture, of any class, faces in setting off to resolve it. There is this wonderful book called The Hero with a Thousand Faces by Joseph Campbell, and it weaves together many mythologies from all the continents, all the cultures in the through the distant past and the present, and how there's a common theme for this journey. And it starts with separation. First is the awareness of separation and the movement away. In Zen terms, we could say this separation is, this feeling of separation is the problem. But still, we have to act when we face this. And so there is this sense of a departure on the journey. And the, in a way, one of the preeminent stories about this is Siddhartha leaving home. Here he was, set up as the heir apparent to his father's throne. He had every reason to just hang in there in the royal palace, on his surrounded by every kind of pleasure that was the privilege of royalty at the time. But then he encountered these four sights: a sick person, an old, aging person, a corpse, and a monk. And this shook him to his core, realizing that this is what we signed up for in being born: sickness, an injury, old age, eventually death. And now began the journey. He left the palace. He could not go on living in that gilded cage. He left the palace because he could not do otherwise. He had to go out and try to resolve these existential matters. And then he did the ascetic path, self-punishment, for a full 6 years, till he nearly died from it. As Joseph Campbell says, fabulous forces encountered and a decisive victory won. Trials. Siddhartha subjected himself to all kinds of trials until he set himself beneath the Bodhi tree and everything changed. But he didn't just remain sitting there in the rapture of his supreme enlightenment. He realized that he had to go out and respond to the suffering in the world. And so comes the third part of this journey, the return. Separation, initiation, and return. And in his return, he came back and reintegrated with his society, with his own people. Our journey is not that different. It begins with a realization that this is the condition we have to come to terms with, is suffering. And separation or departure can simply mean recognizing that we can't go on doing things in the same way. We have to go out and find a different way. We have to find the way. And it's always because of some pain, dissatisfaction. Why would Siddhartha have left the palace if he were satisfied there? Why would Feng Shui have set off on his spiritual journey if he had passed that civil service examination? But what is the problem? We know the problem is suffering, the first of the Four Noble Truths. And what does that come from? Well, the Buddha discovered it comes from egoistic craving and delusion. Egoistic, where does that come from? It comes from dividing the world to any number of ways. And where does the dividing come from? It comes from this conceptualizing mind. In a way, we've all ventured to leave this world that we've created with our conceptual mind, this world of dualisms, of this and that, of higher and lower, success and failure, this world of past, present, and future, of here and there, of life and death. And we are fortunate to have such a clear, crystal clear diagnosis of the problem and medicine, that the cause of our sorrow is ego delusion. That is, being ruled by this discursive intellect and believing in these divisions that it has created. The great Chinese master Obaku said the following: were you now to practice keeping your minds motionless at all times, whether walking, standing, sitting, or lying down, concentrating entirely upon the goal of no thought creation, no duality, no reliance on others and no attachments, just allowing all things to take their course the whole day long as though you were too ill to bother, unknown to the world, innocent of any urge to be known or unknown to others, with your minds like blocks of stone that mend no holes, then all the dharmas would penetrate your understanding through and through. In a little while, you would find yourselves firmly unattached. Thus, for the first time in your lives, you would discover your reactions to phenomena decreasing, and ultimately, you would pass beyond the triple world, and people would say that a Buddha had appeared in the world. He's talking about the initiation now, the middle stage. Pure and passionless knowledge implies putting an end to the ceaseless flow of thoughts and images, for in that way you stop creating the karma that leads to rebirth. If no particle of dust is raised, the state will perish. This is an immense, immense journey, indescribably formidable project we've undertaken to come to resolve the great matter of birth and death and the suffering that comes from having created this world. When there is not a single thought that we attach to, let's say in our sitting, it's most likely to happen, then where is that great edifice of suffering, that wheel of sickness, injuries, the inexorable ravages of aging, of loss, losing people close to us, losing our faculties little by little, usually. And even before we die, seeing others die. Where is all that? That great wheel of samsara. It's not even time when we are absorbed single-mindedly in our practice. There's no time, there's no self. There's no world. There's no problem. It's absolutely essential that we realize that we have within our capacity, within our grasp, the very engine of suffering and the way out of it. That was the third noble truth. There is a way out. And the unique thing about the Zen school is that it's this very specific point of how we are using or misusing the mind, which is something we revisit moment by moment. We keep getting another chance to free ourselves from this wheel. We're the beneficiaries of this Dharma. We have a path before us, unlike the Buddha, who had to find the path. There's a kind of a prose poem from Sweden. It's called The Ballad of the Paths in Vestmanland by Lars Gustafsson. And here's how it goes. Under the visible script of small tracks, gravel tracks, forest tracks, often with a grass ridge in the middle, between deep ruts hidden beneath twigs heaped in clearings, still distinct in crumbling moss, another script runs, the old paths. They lead from lake to lake, from valley to valley. Sometimes deeper furrows, more distinct, and sturdy bridges of medieval stone carry them over black streams. Sometimes they evaporate on bare, rocky ground. You lose them easily in swamps, so imperceptibly that one moment they are there and the next not. Does that sound familiar in Sashin? They do go on. Always there's a going on. You only have to seek. The paths are obstinate. They know what they want. And with that knowledge, they combine considerable cunning. You walk east. The compass points insistently east. Faithfully, the path follows the compass like a streak. All is well. Then the path veers north. And north, there's nothing. What does the path want? Soon comes an enormous moor, and the path knew it. It leads us around with the certainty of someone who knows what's what. It knows where the moor is. It knows where the hill is too steep. It knows what happens to someone who circles the lake to the north instead of the south. It has done it all so many times before. That's the whole path of being a path. That's the whole point of being a path. It came to be made long ago. Again, it is our privilege to have this method, clear as can be. Not easy, but simple, uncomplicated. Each time we notice our mind has drifted into thought, we come back to the path, the practice. Again and again and again and again. It's all laid out for us. It just takes perseverance and faith, above all faith in the path, the method. We have to notice when we are giving rise to thoughts. It's all in the noticing. And that noticing becomes more acute with every passing hour of sesshin, and more generally with years of practice, because whatever our practice is, it is leading us into this realm of no mind, and in that realm of no mind, all of the movements of the mind, the thoughts, become more clear. There's the noticing. The more empty the mind becomes, the more conspicuous are the remaining thoughts. And this can lead one to discouragement at times. Okay, I've been sitting 5 days, 6 days, and still there are these thoughts that are hanging on. Well, they're probably thoughts that you wouldn't even have noticed a few days ago. That's how much sharper our awareness becomes. There's another danger, especially in these last 2 or 3 days of sesshin, is, we talked about makyo, about these side effects, these unusual mental or physical states. There's one in particular that can really wreak havoc with us is when we allow ourselves to worm our way into some obsessive thought. It's because our concentration is stronger that we can get lost in such a thing, a thought, a memory, even a distant memory. Can get lodged in the mind, and we lose our perspective. We lose our distance from it. We become completely wrapped up in this one thing, maybe from long ago, or maybe from right here in sesshin, some little drama with someone else in sesshin, and it then acquires this huge significance, coming to the front and center of one's mind. We have to notice, we have to have the presence of mind to realize when were going down that rabbit hole and recognize that just as easily as we got into it, we can get out of it again using the practice. These kinds of thoughts or things could be like Velcro. They can stick to the mind for half an hour, 2 hours. But then, just by continuing to sit, we suddenly realize it's gone. What seemed like in kind of insurmountable issue in our mind vanishes. Of course it does. It's a thought. Memories are thoughts too. It has no roots to it, no matter how strong it may be, so imposing, so menacing. It's got no roots. It has no form to it, except as it may appear, illusory form. I think the more sesshins you've been to, the more you're likely to spot this early enough where it doesn't lead you astray for a day or two. But has no more substance to it than even just an innocent little flickering thought in the mind. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions. I vow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attend.